Pets are a great part of our life, a wonderful part of our life. They cheer us up. They stay by our side. They give us that unconditional love, which is so wonderful. I know life just wouldn't be the same without them. And we're lucky that Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine is at our side, too. She's with us every month to talk about what's going on with our pets, how to keep them healthy and happy. Sandy, great to have you back.
It is nice to be here. I was just at a meeting this weekend that was on animal behavior, and I'm the advisor for the Animal Behavior Club at the vet school, and it was so nice to see so many of the state and surrounding states' veterinarians and how many of them actually listened to this show and said that, you know, they really, you know, think that I, you know, that you and I do a great job. But it was just so nice to get that feedback that from some of my colleagues that, you know, you're doing a good thing out there.
Yeah, well, that's wonderful. I love that.
I know. And, you know, and it's just I feel that it's just one of my things with outreach to, you know, get out there and help people. And it, you know, you'd be surprised where I get questions in the grocery store, in public. Public restrooms, you know. But this is their chance now to call me on the radio.
Yeah, here's your chance. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. That's the place to go, The Larry Mueller Show. And if you have a photo, a pet photo, we always love the pet photos. So put one up on the Facebook page. And you know, Valentine, you know, we've got callers online already, but and we'll get to Jackie and Mary in just a minute here. But Valentine's Day coming up. We've talked about it yesterday, talked about making chocolate and making candy.
Oh, yeah.
But when it comes to our pets.
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, the big things I think about are, you know, those that romantic dinner with drinks and wine and so on. And a lot of pets will get into things like that. So you have to be really careful around alcohol and stuff around your house with pets, especially with dogs. And the other big thing is chocolate. And kind of our little rule of thumb is an ounce of milk chocolate per pound of body weight is considered, like, it could potentially be lethal levels. But there's a really interesting free app that you can get for your smartphone called Chalk Talks. And it's a calculator that you put in the weight of your dog, the kind of chocolate they ate, and approximately how much you think they ate. And you push a button, and if it comes up red, that means get your pet to the vet right away. So it's just a nice little thing to have on hand since it's one of our more common toxicities that we see in pets.
You know, and I was surprised. I think you mentioned it to me. Candles.
Yeah, people like candles. And then I actually had a friend not too long ago that called an emergency and said, do you have anything like scissors, clippers, or anything? Can you help hold our cat? The cat had tipped over a candle and got its half its body covered with liquid wax. Thank goodness it didn't burn the cat. The cat had a long enough hair coat. But we really have to be careful when we have things like that out because, you know, pets can not only maybe cause potential fires in the house, but burns and so on would be a possibility as well.
Well, Jackie in Drummond does have a question, so I want to go to her. Jackie, hi. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you so much. I just really have a dilemma. About 2 months ago, I was hiking on the Berkey Trail, and the sheriff came up to me and said, did I lose a dog? And I said, no. Long story short, this black puppy, who was probably about 6 months old, was dumped, and I made the mistake of adopting him. And now I think he's got some pit bull in him, and he's pretty nice, but he's so aggressive when he wants to play. You know, he tries to get my mittens and tries to nip, and I have a hard time distracting him. I've used some bitter apple. But I'm just wondering if this aggressiveness is part of a pit bull or he just doesn't get enough exercise. But it's a little challenging. Outside of that, he's a pretty nice dog, but he has these fits of being strong.
Yeah.
And I can't be alpha. So help me.
Well, I think, you know, a few things come to mind here. One is, you know, adopting a pet is a huge commitment, and it's not something that you, as you know, just take on. And but thank you for giving this dog a home. And, you know, and number two is the stereotypes we have about certain breeds. And, you know, any breed that isn't getting enough exercise, isn't going through training class, isn't taught to, you know, have impulse control and so on, is going to start behaving like your dog does. I mean, I have to admit, I've had crazy bulldogs as well that, you know, want to jump and tug and so on. So One of the things that I just picked up at this weekend's meeting is one of the main speakers there is a doctor named Dr. Yin, Y-I-N. And she is a doctor out in California that has a number of publications and so on behavior and a lot of free things on her website as well. And her name's Sophia Yin. One thing that she promotes is this program that she calls Learn to Earn. She says she has people, when they bring a new dog in, actually wear the dog with a leash, preferably a hands-free leash, so like around your belt, like it took it to your belt or something, and you take all the dog's food, and every time that dog is with you, you're having them learn to sit and wait, and they get a piece of food. Sit and wait, and they get a piece of food. And so you're just constantly looking at not just training for that half hour every day or going to training class, but every moment of the day working with them. That might be something that you would want to look into, but, you know, in the meantime, I think, you know, working with an applied animal behaviorist so that you aren't injured, and, you know, giving this dog some structure to their life through, you know, appropriate play, some training and so on. So the dog learns that I get everything I want in life if I sit and wait and am well behaved. So
yep. Classes. And
yeah, that's, you know, very, very typical. So the time to start is a lot of fun, actually. Yeah, it will be. And if this dog, you know, is, you know, friendly with other dogs and so on, she may even find that things like doggy daycare would be a great place for this dog to burn off some steam and play appropriately. But they do have to be dog friendly to be able to go to a place like that.
Good luck, Jackie. Thank you for calling. Mary in Belleville, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. First of all, I just like to say how much my husband and I appreciate the UW Vet Clinic emergency room and staff. It's such a peace of mind knowing that they're available. We've made use of them a few times over the years, and we just really appreciate the service.
No, thank you very much. Yeah, it is open 24 hours. It's walk-in. I mean, if you have a minute to call and say, hey, my dog's bleeding or whatever, but we have someone there, you know, 365 days a year, you know, and, you know, equipped for any kind of emergency you can throw at us. Yep.
I have a question about heartworm. My husband and I have adopted 6 dogs from rescue over the years, schnauzers. And every now and then when you're looking at rescue dogs, they'll say that they've had heartworm, that they've been treated. And I just wonder how does having had heartworm affect the rest of your life? Are there health problems? Does it shorten their life? What kind of implications does that mean for a dog's future once they've had heartworm and been treated for it?
That's a very good question. I mean, a treatment itself can be hard on the dog. It is time consuming. It is injectable medications that have to be given over a series of injections with strict rest for, you know, a couple of months where, you know, those worms are slowly dying. So it's so much easier to prevent heartworm disease than go through treatment. And I'd have to say that it depends on kind of the level of illness that the dog had with heartworm. We see many dogs that on paper are heartworm positive, but have very little changes when we take chest x-rays or anything like that. And it's amazing how even after a dog that has clinical heartworm disease is coughing and has exercise intolerance, if they go through appropriate therapy, all the steps of it, everything seems to bounce back and they seem to be, you know, lead just as much of a normal life as a dog that never did have heartworm disease. But, you know, so I don't think that would be something that would deter me from adopting a dog if they've gone through appropriate treatment.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah. You're welcome. Well,
thanks a lot for calling. Lenora in Mauston, hi.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
I have a cat question.
Okay.
I have a cat that I adopted. I have a couple other ones, but she does not have any fur from her tail to the middle of her back. Her butt is furless.
Huh.
What can I do for her? And okay. I don't know why. We bathe her and everything.
Yeah.
But we can't get her to have hair, and she looks funny with no hair in her bum.
Does she rub her butt, or does she...
You don't see her scratching or licking or grooming that area. Yeah.
Nope.
Well, number one, get her into a vet clinic to have her skin evaluated. When we see cats that have hair losses, particularly in that pattern, probably my number one thing I think about is something called flea allergy dermatitis. All it takes for a cat or a dog that has a flea allergy problem, because it's the saliva that is being left behind by the flea bite is one flea bite to trigger an allergic response. So if you have even just a low level of flea infestation in your home, that may keep this problem going. And they tend to get, I call it baboon butt, where they get that, you know, that strip of skin right above their tail head will be bald and hairless. But there's other causes too besides fleas. We'll see allergic dermatitis. Cats that have allergies to other things in the environment will sometimes pick a spot, and we call it fur mowing, like mowing your grass or barbering. Sometimes they'll do it to their legs, sometimes to their abdomen. And when you start asking owners, do you ever see them grooming? They'll say no, you know. And so we call these cats closet groomers. They may do it when they're not being watched. And the way we can tell that they may be over-grooming is we pluck some of the little stubby hairs out and look at them under the microscope. And rather than having the normal point to the hair, like a normal hair would have, they're all chewed up. And so it tells us that something's been chewing on the ends of these hairs and breaking them off. There's a whole host of things that we start looking into, from, you know, making sure that they're on good flea control, because that's the easiest thing, even for an indoor pet, to be on. And then we may be looking for other skin parasites. We might go down the dietary allergy route. We may look at environmental allergens. So there are things that can be done, but it's often a kind of a slow process until we hit on what's actually causing the problem. So
does the hair come back, can it come back?
Oh, definitely. We see these cats that have barbered their hair coat, and usually their skin is pristine. There's no scabs, there's no crusts, and all of us, you know, and then they just, whatever, we stop them from licking, and away you go. The hair grows right back in.
Oh, so, yeah. Wonderful.
So
all right.
They don't have to invest in a kitty toupee or anything. No.
Okay. Lenora, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. We talked about chocolate and dogs, not good for dogs. Mm-hmm. Somebody wondered about, what about cats? Is chocolate not good for cats?
Chocolate isn't good for cats either, but cats tend to be a little more discriminating with their what they eat. And so if you have a cat that likes to raid your M&Ms or your, you know, candy jar or whatever, then obviously you need to keep them away from them. But it's just that we see dogs tend to be the ones that can counter surf and get into things, and just a little more of a problem for dogs than cats. Patients.
And you mentioned that app that we could put on our smartphone that would help us figure out if the chocolate, you know, if our dog is eating too much chocolate.
Yep.
What is that app again?
And it's called, if you just plug, it's called Chalk Talks. I'm just pulling it up on my phone here because I have it right there. Chocktox.
So. All right. And you know what? Judith's already got it down. We're going to post it on my Facebook page.
Great.
So it's at the Larry. It'll be at the Larry Mueller Show in just a matter of a minute. I'm sure of that, and you'll be able to go right to it. Also at the Facebook page, at the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, Richard sent a great photo of his cat Boots.
Oh, what a beautiful tuxedo cat. Look at that.
Wow.
And his pupils are he is so intent on watching something outside with that bright sun. Beautiful picture.
Yeah, that is just that absolutely gorgeous. The pupils are they just really closed?
They're just really closed. Just like if we were out in the bright sun, our pupils would be very tiny. This is what cats look like when they're looking into bright light. Most people, especially like us in the vet clinic, we usually see cats with dilated pupils because they're scared and their pupils may be a little bit bigger.
Well, there is a Boots, you're a beautiful cat. I'll say that for you. John in Menominee Falls, it's your turn. Hi, John.
Hey, Larry. Good to talk to you. Warts on dogs is Sean Poodle Mix.
Mm-hmm.
Background, is this a virus, or we've had them removed once. They've come back again in larger numbers. I've heard that the virus, I'm not so certain on that. Could you give us some
background? Well, we do see a papillomavirus in dogs, and usually dogs that get the papilloma or the wart virus are going to have areas in their mouth and along their lips are the most common way they get them. And because it is a virus, it's usually spread through saliva, and we'll often see younger dogs, especially, you know, puppies to young adult dogs come in with maybe one little wart in their mouth, or they sometimes can be so severe that the whole oral cavity, even down into their, you know, the back of their throat and so on, may be affected. And then you're looking at surgical removal to be able to get them under control. So those are the true warts that we see. Most of the things that people identify as warts are actually small skin growths called sebaceous adenomas or other types of skin growths. And they kind of look like little pink cauliflower bits that, and they can spring up all over the place. In fact, my 9 and a half, almost 10-year-old female bulldog has one coming up right on her forehead. And with her having that short white hair coat and this little pink nubbin sitting right there, it's more of an eyesore than anything. And it's just a common age related thing. They can sometimes get nicked when their dogs are being groomed. They can be, you know, get infected if the dog's bothering them. And sometimes we have to remove them. But for the most part, you know, removal is, you know, for cosmetic reasons. The owner just doesn't want to have a look at them. If you, there, we do sometimes see warts on other places of the body, the true viral warts, and they look different. They have kind of a little finger-like projections of tissue. The way to get a diagnosis is if you have to get one of these removed, have it sent in for histopathology, where we can actually tell you what's causing this thing. But yeah. That would be my guess, is that this dog probably has some other type of benign skin growth like an adenoma.
There you go. Thanks a lot for calling. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor of veterinary medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Larry Mueller here. Thanks so much for listening in today. Questions? Go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. You can post a photo there or a question there. And as a matter of fact, I should just mention this again because this is so cute. We've got English Setter Wally. And is that an appropriate name? Is that a Wally or is that a Wally?
Oh, my goodness. They are such cool, goofy-looking dogs, though. And, you know, one of the things that I wanted to bring up is the popularity of breeds. And I just looked up where English Setters are on the updated AKC list of dogs. They fall at number 87. 10 years ago, they were at 94. So they've increased in popularity a little bit. But typically, when we see these dogs coming in, they are, you know, they usually have a good temperament. They're fairly healthy. And that tells me that, you know, when they're not as popular, people are a little more selective about how they're bred. As dogs become that higher popularity, you start people looking into, like, I can make a buck selling these because there's demand now. And unfortunately, I'm going to, you know, just tout my own favorite breed because I have two of them at home. I love all dogs.
Bulldogs.
And they have gone from number 18 to number 5. And I, you know, I just brought
movie? Is there a movie out with bulldogs?
No, it's just, I think, you know, I brought in just one of my vet journals that has very few advertisements in it, but there are 5 advertisements, even some funky ones, that use bulldogs. And so you start looking through any pet publication, anything, they've just have become so popular.
Suddenly.
And I think it's just because they're kind of, you know, funny looking and a little more photogenic and so on. But Wally, you're definitely photogenic. So, you know, when a breed reaches popularity like that, really be careful that you're working with a reputable breeder. Know what you're getting into. Know the health problems because, boy, I just know we're going to be seeing more of them coming through the door and a lot of disappointed new puppy owners.
You know, the other thing that has always interested me was how people have viewed certain breeds of dogs. Because at one point, well, now pit bulls are, you know, we had a question about pit bulls earlier, kind of out of favor, worried about pit bulls. I think at one time it was the German Shepherd that everybody hated.
Yeah, well, German Shepherds were number 3 10 years ago, and now they're number 2. They were the number 1 dog, and I think I read about a year ago the book on the history of Rin Tin Tin, and how that particular dog being in the movies really promoted the breed in the United States, and how that affected the temperament and the health of these dogs because there were so many people that wanted them. They just were mass producing them. And things kind of, they fell out of favor and now they're coming back again. But we've got people that are, you know, more interested in making sure they've got good hips and good temperament and they're not seizuring and, you know, and so on. So We do see these kind of things ebb and flow over time. And then, you know, when you've got dogs on the other end that are not very popular, you've got that very small genetic pool, and you're usually dealing with a lot of health problems as well.
At that end. Yeah. All right. Well, now you haven't given us the number one. I am trying to guess what would be the number one dog, and I'm trying to think. It wouldn't be Collie.
No. Collies were, when Lassie was very popular, and then we started to see all these Collies that have, they're blind because they've got inherited eye diseases and so on, but it's the Labrador Retriever is number one, and they have been number one for the last 10 years. So.
Oh, Judith's raising her hand like she scored, and look at it, she put Black Lab up. So it's Black Lab?
Just labs in general.
Labs in general.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. So now we got to worry about whether or not they're going to be overbred.
Yeah, unfortunately, many of them are. And you have to know what you're getting into before you adopt and, you know, bring a pet into your life.
Joe and DePere, thanks a lot for waiting. Hi.
Hi. I just recently, within the last week, adopted a wire-haired terrier. From rescue, and she had mange, and I'm trying to think of if the non-contagious kind, diabetic or something like that.
Demodex is the name, demodectic mange, yes.
She just finished her medicine, and we've got an appointment set up for the vet in a couple of weeks. What are the odds of this stuff coming back?
Yeah, this is, that's a good question. When puppies are born, everybody, just like in humans, we all have mites living on us, in our eyelashes and so on. And it's just normal to have, it's hard to believe, but these critters living on our bodies. Dogs all have this low level of this mite that lives in the hair follicles, and it's called Demodex. And when puppies are born, moms will pass these off to their puppies. And if we have a puppy that has some type of an underlying immune problem, they're very stressed, something's happened to them that way, these mites can sometimes take over and they'll start multiplying to large numbers. And then, of course, the hair can't stay in the follicle. You'll get secondary infections. They start losing hair. You know, it can be all over their body. But there's kind of a couple of types of Demodex that we'll see in dogs. We'll get the kind that is very focal. It may just, with some treatment, go away, and the dog never looks back. My male bulldog, I believe in his previous medical records, had a minor bout of this and has never looked back from it. We'll see some dogs that are plagued with this and need to be on kind of prolonged treatment for the rest of their life, that they just have some type of underlying immune problem, and they can be healthy, happy, normal pets, except for the fact that they just need to be treated. And the treatment over the last few years has really changed. It used to be that we would have to shave dogs and use this awful smelling dip, and they would not do well with it, and you'd have to do like a third of their body at a time, and so it was not very fun. But now we've got these spot-on treatments that are used for flea control and heartworm control. There's one that we're using in the clinic that's called Advantage Multi. Typically, it's used monthly on dogs that don't have this as a problem. But when we have a problem with Demodex, they will need to be on it usually every couple of weeks. And that seems to be one of the most effective, safest things to be able to use to get it under control. So it may mean that you're going to have to spend a little bit more money on your heartworm and flea control, because instead of using it monthly, you're using it every couple of weeks. But once your dog has been treated and had a couple of negative skin scrapings, it's just a matter of then monitoring for, you know, future areas of hair loss or anything like that. So it would not prevent me from adopting a dog.
All right. Thanks a lot, Joel.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, appreciate it. Renee in Chippewa Falls, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. We took in a black lab last April, and he's actually 9 today. And we were told that he had allergies and ear infections. And so we thought, well, that's okay. We took him to the vet, and he did have an ear infection, and we cleared that up. And then we gave him a bath because he had been living in a basement, and we don't think he ever had a bath. And then the itching started, and then the red ears. He's got red hot ears most of the time, and we had the same vet that they had for our dog. We have two dogs now, And so they, he had actually had surgery in his ears, and they thought maybe that it's allergies, so we've switched him to different foods, and right now he's on Iams, lamb, and rice, mm-hmm. and he still has red ears. There's no infection, and he's got white dander in his fur. Seems like the bath made it worse.
Yeah. But. Well, I think you're bringing up a number of topics here. Labs are definitely the poster child when it comes to dealing with allergic skin disease. When we get allergies, we get hay fever, our eyes run, our nose runs. When dogs get allergies, they itch. And it may be confined to the ears. It may be ears and feet. It may just be feet. It may be all over the body. And when we have a dog that is predisposed to allergies, you have to look at it as being a lifetime commitment to be keeping things under control. And so here's what typically happens. You've got a dog that gets exposed to something that they're allergic to. Their ears, just like our nose gets red and our eyes gets red, the dog's ears get a little red and warm. And because it's warmer and moister in there, because of the inflammation, the normal inhabitants of the ear will start to multiply. So bacteria that are there, yeasts that are there, that are just going to add to the redness. And so getting rid of the infection is just part of it. It's the long-term commitment to using some type of an anti-inflammatory. If the ears are the only thing that's affected, you may want to talk to your veterinarian about using something like a dexamethasone eardrop, a steroid eardrop without antibiotics in it, because you know that will get the redness down, get rid of the swelling, and make the dog feel more comfortable and help prevent future infections from coming back again. But it's one of those things where you just can't forget about it. I'll have people that treat the fire, you know, put the fire out with a bad ear infection, and then it comes right back again. And so, you know, routine cleaning, using a steroid eardrop, or depending on how bad it is, sometimes we even have to resort to oral medication like cyclosporine to help stop some of the reactions that are occurring with the allergies. And your thought on putting your dog on a lamb and rice diet is probably the biggest misconception people have regarding food allergies. When dogs develop allergies, it's usually to the proteins in the food. It can be other things, but it's usually the proteins. And back probably 40 years ago, before lamb was a common ingredient in pet food, we as veterinarians would have people go out and buy mutton and cook lamb and rice for their dogs, because rice wasn't found in dog food, lamb wasn't found in dog food, but guess what? It's everywhere now. And so these lamb-based dog foods, lamb is just as allergenic as any of the other proteins you're going to use. So if you truly want to find out if your dog has a food allergy, you need to go through an appropriate elimination diet trial. And what that means is that for a good 10 to sometimes 12 weeks, usually we'll get some response before 8 weeks is up, but you know, plan on a three-month commitment of feeding a very specialized diet. We usually go to a hydrolyzed protein diet where the dog's body isn't going to recognize where that protein is comes from. Most of the diets that are made like this are based on chicken, and chicken is one of the things that dogs are very allergic to, if you had to look at the top five. But the dog isn't going to recognize that that's coming from chicken. And you get that and only that. So no treats, no table scraps, even their heartworm preventative that is usually in a meaty beef-based cube or beef-flavored things, you have to switch over to a topical medication. So we're very strict about it to see if your dog gets better. If they do, then you can either keep them on that diet or start doing adding in things to see what your dog is actually allergic to. Start reading that bag of the lamb dog food, and I would bet you're going to see that there's chicken fat in it, that there's wheat in it, that there's soya in it. And so you have to be, if you've got a dog with food allergies, a label reader. And your dog may not be allergic to food. It may be house dust mites or something else that is there in the home that could be bothering your dog. So
another question is our other dog, who is submissive to him, she's only a year and a half. She licks his ears, and he seems to just love that. Is that hurting any?
Oh, yeah. What that's doing is her yucky saliva that is full of bacteria is getting down in that ear, and it's also making it more moist. You can't let her lick, and she probably is licking because it smells, and it's like, okay, there's something gross here. Because she's a dog, she's going to lick it. So, yeah, you're going to have to keep her away from those ears if you can help it. Yeah, that's not something that you want to have her do.
And thanks a lot for calling. Good luck. Appreciate it. We had a Facebook question from Karen, whose friend has a lab mix with a Pseudomonas ear problem. She's trying a diet change to single protein, single carb, every kind of antibiotic combination. Relief minimal. Anything to add?
Yeah, when we have recurrent infections like this, one of the things that we always want to do is make sure it's cultured and we get a culture and sensitivity. The fact that she knows what the bacteria is tells me that the veterinarian has probably done that. Sometimes it hasn't been done. Sometimes we're making a guess that it's a real stinky ear and we look on the slide and we see rod-shaped bacteria and we say, oh, that's probably Pseudomonas. But it needs to be cultured and the sensitivity checked. And especially if a lot of antibiotics are thrown at it, Pseudomonas is one of those bacteria that's kind of like our resistant staphs that we're seeing that tends to be resistant to a lot of the antibiotics that we use. If it is a recurrent problem, then you may be looking at, you know, do we have an infection that's actually deeper? Is it in the bone? Is it in the middle ear cavity? And so some of these dogs, we need to be doing video otoscope work where we go in with the video so we can look while the dog's under anesthesia. Sometimes we need to do specialized imaging like CT scans of the skull to see if we have a middle ear infection. These can be really nasty problems to get under control. And you're looking at often weeks of systemic or like oral antibiotics rather than just topical. And then it's a matter of just like the last caller finding out why this dog is getting recurrent ear infections. And, you know, does it have some underlying problem like allergies that is making the ear environment more suitable for this bug to grow? So it's a big deal to deal with.
Teresa wonders if you have any fun guinea pig tips for play and recreation.
Yeah, you know, my daughter used to have a guinea pig, and I knew I was in trouble when my pitcher in her locker at school got replaced by her guinea pig's pitcher. What was his name? Wally, I think was his name. I can't remember. But anyway, she had a big, one of those big balls that they can run in, and they make big wheels that they can run in, tubes and things that they can crawl through. But guinea pigs are very social animals. They love to be out, and they love to be with people, and not just confining them to the cage and expecting them to entertain themselves. They do require a little more human input than many of your rodent-type pets.
Julie has a cat who has a rodent ulcer, speaking about that keeps coming back. I'm not sure what a rodent ulcer is. They're now going to have the cat start on prescription food. Mm-hmm. Is this necessary? It's pretty expensive.
Yeah, well, this just happens to be one of the things that cats will manifest with allergic skin disease. And what a rodent, it's a complex of skin problems that we get in cat that are called eosinophilic granuloma complex. That's a lot of words for this problem where they'll get either ulcers on their lips or they'll get these very red ulcerated areas sometimes on the back of their legs or other places on their abdomen or a number of places. And so we see kind of three different syndromes that that present like this, and one of them happens to be nicknamed rodent ulcer. It usually is steroid responsive, and that tells us that this is probably an allergic type problem. Problem with using steroids is that it will have secondary side effects, and they will often come back. And I would be doing exactly the same thing as this veterinarian has recommended, is
okay,
putting this cat on a hydrolyzed protein diet for a good, 10 to 12 weeks. Yes, it's expensive, but it's so much easier and better for the cat to get that off the table. If your cat doesn't respond to that, then we'd be looking at maybe your cat is allergic to other things in the environment, and then we start going down that path. So I agree with her veterinarian.
Coco in Green Bay. Hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I have a question about my 3.5-year-old female tabby. We adopted her as a kitten, 8 weeks old, and she's a perfect cat. about 9 months ago, we adopted another kitten for a companion for her. And I don't know if that was the best idea, even though the new kitten is wonderful. Chu has begun over-grooming terribly. In fact, the vet said it was one of the worst cases he's seen of over-grooming.
Oh, boy.
And recently, yeah, recently we discovered, too, that she, it kind of looks like a small road rash, but she did affect the skin a little bit.
Okay, so she's really itchy. It's not just I'm grooming my hair out. In the past, we used to think that cats that were over grooming, we call it psychogenic alopecia, where we think it was like her brain telling her, you know, like someone biting their fingernails to the quick, or you know, pulling their hair out themselves. It was like a compulsive disorder that cats would do when they were stressed. We are now looking at this syndrome where cats like over-groom themselves, and especially if there are skin changes associated with it, where you've got some scabbing or damage to the top layer of the skin, that there may be something else going on. And the fact that this was timed with the introduction of a new pet, yes, it could be psychological, but I would really be worried about something contagious. And probably the biggest contagions that we see in cats are this, a mite that is a little, it's, even though it's the same kind of family of mites that we talked about in dogs that is not contagious, cats have a Demodex mite of their own that is contagious. And many cats don't show any symptoms of it, and other cats do exactly what your cat is showing. And so,
She actually started, it wasn't right away, it was probably about 2 months ago.
Okay.
And we're assuming it's from the stress because, you know, Yo-Yo was really hyper. She's calmed down a lot since, but you can tell when Yo-Yo's around, they can groom each other once in a while, but you can tell just by the way Chu meows.
Okay.
And walks away that
okay.
It seems like it's a stress thing from Yo-Yo, and it's kind of like a condition that was brought out of Chu.
Yeah, it may be. You know? It might be, but I would still, you have to go through, jump through the hoops of a medical workup. There's a really good information center. It's called Veterinary Partners, I believe it's called. If you Google fur mowing in cats, and like mowing your lawn, I've been mentioning that second time I mentioned the show, they have it all broken down there as kind of the steps that you take to make this diagnosis. And if you came to see me, I would be convincing you that you have to go through this, like some dipping. And we would probably be using a lime sulfur dip, which is not a lot of fun. Larry's been down that path with one of his
cats.
Yes. But I'd probably be looking at that. I'd be doing some skin scrapings to look for these mites and checking a stool sample, because when we have cats with these mites, they're grooming themselves because they're itchy, and sometimes we find the mites in the stool sample. So I would look into that rather than this just being stress. I think it, you know, we rarely see cats actually mutilating themselves with stress. So,
there you go.
Yeah.
Good luck, Coco.
Yeah. But, you know, this is comes down to when you start looking at statistics in the pet-owning population, the average number of cats in the American family now is 2.1. And cats that are, you know, grow up by themselves, you really have to think twice about adding in another cat, because they may not be very social. And you never get another cat for the existing cat. You get another cat for yourself, because you may have to live in a house divided. So my rule of thumb is, if you want a multi-cat household, start with one. Get two cats at the same time.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking Your Pet's Health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. Great to have you listening in. Great to have her with us. Questions? Call us at 800-642-1234. Or photo or another question you can send to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show as well. And we've got a great photo up right now. As a matter of fact, Marge sent one of her brand new baby tuxedo kitty, Kiel, being watched over by the photos of two of her late kitties,
and you know,
Fluffy and Tiggy.
What's really nice to see is she's got a big cat tree for this cat.
Yeah.
And so often for cats, they love to be up high, and then they get in trouble because they get onto bookshelves and knock things off. I just bought a new cat tree for my cats. It's 7 feet tall. It's got three resting platforms, a couple of cubbies.
and it's just so neat to see these the 10 plus year old
too,
cats having a great time on it. It's like they've gone from being these, you know, kind of sit around and not do much to, oh boy, we've got a new toy. So that's great that she's got that.
Sharon in Ontario, Wisconsin, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi there. We've got the lab border collie dog at 8 months old. She's now 9 months old, but she has a lot of itching she's doing. And we were kind of wondering what we should be doing for, like, the food or what bath we can do, if we can use baby oil in the bath or just what to do for her.
Yeah, you know, we don't see allergies in young dogs that often. I mean, it's not impossible. We have, you know, periodically we'll get a puppy that's only a few months of age in with allergic skin disease, but it's usually you're looking at dogs that are, you know, a year and a half, 2 years of age that start to show some symptoms. So I would put allergies kind of down lower on my list. When I see a dog that's doing a lot of licking and itching, I start worrying about primarily external parasites. And so I just mentioned this, you know, mite in cats. We seem to be on a roll with mites, but there's several that dogs can get. I had a dog in last week with scabies, and the dog was just miserable. And just after a week of treatment, the dog says it's got its life back. It's just so much more comfortable. But there's another mite that's given the nickname Walking Dandruff that may cause a little dandruffy areas on the coat, but it's called Kylotiella. I think what I would be recommending is, and I'm sounding like a broken record, but a visit to your veterinarian to get a diagnosis where they can do some skin scrapings, actually have a look to make sure that your dog doesn't have something as simple as lice, which we'll see in the winter as well. I mean, that's when we tend to see more of them, cases in the winter, because animals are cuddling up with each other, that can sometimes be very, very easily treated. But before you start, you know, doing your home remedies, get a diagnosis, so that an appropriate therapy can be started and make your dog feel a lot more comfortable.
All right. There you go, Sharon. Thank you for calling. We have Dave in Rowie. I'm not sure. I don't know that town. Hi, Dave.
Rowie. How are you doing? Rowie, down by Platteville.
Oh, okay. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. I've got about a 6-year-old miniature dachshund male. And for years, when he got done drinking, he'd cough really progressively harder until it's like he finally got something out of his throat. Then in the last year, it's turned into an inverted sneeze, and a lot of them. And then it's went to a really hard sneeze. Now, and back and forth between these. Now it's to the point where he let him out of his kennel in the morning, and he'll sneeze 5 to 15 times really hard, sometimes a lot of snot, sometimes not. And, like, when I get home in the afternoon, I let him out of his kennel. He'll do that sneezing routine. He'll get out of it, then he'll do a series just kind of all the time of small little sneezes.
Wow. You know,
go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say the coughing after drinking, especially if he's gulping water down, it's not uncommon for it to go down the wrong pathway. And sometimes it, you know, just depends on how the dog is swallowing and excited they are about drinking. That's not that uncommon. But what you're describing, this reverse sneezing and regular sneezing with material coming out, really has me concerned. What have you done for it?
We've been to the vet a lot. We've done kennel cough medications. We've done other medications for some kind of infection, sinus infection. We've done x-rays. We've done blood tests. Everything comes back negative. We've done some human antibiotics. I can't remember which one Pat gave her, but we're doing something constantly. And
okay.
We've been working at this for quite some time. The only difference in the house, we took on a cat from our son who moved to China.
Okay.
And we got the cat, and it's that when it changed into this reverse sneezing and hard sneezing is about the same time we got the cat, and then we slowly transitioned the cat to the downstairs through a screen door and everything from upstairs, and they're coexisting together now.
Okay.
And I don't know if there'd be any kind of allergic reaction to the cat, or
I've never seen a dog become allergic to cats, but it's it's always possible. You know, again, most of the time when we've got dogs that have allergies, they present through their skin and not so much with the respiratory tract, although they can sometimes get a little bit of clear nasal discharge and do some extra sneezing and snuffling and so on. But that tends to be kind of a minor presentation with allergies. You mentioned a few things, that a bunch of antibiotics and things have been thrown at your dog, that x-rays were done. And unfortunately, an x-ray of the sinus passages and the nasal passages, really hard to interpret. You have to do that when they're sound asleep. And so they have to be anesthetized. But the best way of getting imaging done would be to do some specialized imaging like a CT scan or an MRI, which may be something that your veterinarian would have to refer you to another practice to be able to have that done, because not all vets are equipped with that kind of specialized equipment to see if she does have a sinus infection or a foreign body up the nose that is, you know, an area that they can then focus on. When we have a dog that presents like this too, usually after imaging, we're looking at convincing the owner to have rhinoscopy done, where we actually look up the nose to see what may be up there. I mean, it could be something like a tooth root abscess. It could be a foreign body. There may be a nasal tumor in there, a polyp. There's, you know, a whole host of things that could potentially be causing this to be such a recurrent problem for your dog. But there's one simple thing that we see, actually it's fairly common in dogs, but it's called nasal mites. And there's I'm in this mite mode today, but there's a mite that is very contagious. They like to live in the nose, and it can cause reverse sneezing and sneezing. But it responds usually fairly well to the classic things that we put dogs on, like Revolution or Advantage Multi for some of the other skin mites, and heartworm prevention and flea control and so on. So that might be something that you'd want to talk to your veterinarian about, which would be before you start jumping into the nasal extravaganza to find out what's going on with your dog, having your dog treated for nasal mites, just to see if that's the case.
We've got another miniature dachshund also, and nothing is, you know, if it's contagious, nothing's happened to
it. Well, then that probably blows that out of the water. Okay, well, I'll take that back. But so you may be looking at, you know, getting some special imaging and some rhinoscopy done to be able to find out what's going on with your dog. Sounds like your dog's miserable if they can't function and, you know, lead a normal life without sneezing all the time.
Yeah.
Oh, it's terrible. Yeah.
Well, good luck, Dave. Thanks
very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Dan in Phelps, Wisconsin, we turn to you now. Oh, before we go to you, we've got a picture here up on my Facebook page of Izzy. And Kyle, Izzy's owner, says a cat tree might be a good idea for our house.
There you go. You've got the cat up on a dresser or something, and it looks like it's a very nice piece of antique wood. So
yeah.
And
a nice plant that's going to get dropped over.
Yes, it's going to get toppled over and spill water on it, and then he's going to have water stains on the top of his beautiful antique dresser. So, yep, get a cat tree.
All right, Dan, thanks for calling. Hi.
I would like to ask, how does the doctor feel about dog owners cleaning their dog's ears, and how would you do it? And specifically, what I've been doing is injecting with an eyedropper a few drops of a solution that's half alcohol, half vinegar, and wiping it out with a paper towel, and then putting in a couple of drops of baby oil and massaging that into the ear, and then wiping out the excess with paper towel, and I will listen off the air.
Okay. Well, a lot of commercial ear cleaners will have alcohol in them. And so if you've got a dog that's got an ear infection where the ear's abraded, it's raw, if you've ever got alcohol in a cut, you know how that stings and it burns, and it can sometimes be overly drying as well. The big problem with putting vinegar in the ear, it's an aqueous or a water-based solution that's acidifying. And although most commercial ear cleaners are going to be acidifying, you need something that is not, if you've ever put, like, made oil and vinegar salad dressing, you see what happens with, you know, the vinegar, it just sits on top of the oil. Well, that's what's going to happen when it sits on top of the debris in the ears, the waxy debris. So your best bet is to use a commercial ear cleaner that has a surfactant in it, and you're not going to probably have these chemicals at home. So working with your veterinarian to find out what would be an appropriate ear cleaner for your dog. There's many of them on the market out there. Don't use the human ear cleaners. The human ear cleaner, that most of them will have a peroxide base in it. They can burn a dog's ear canal. They're meant to be flushed out. But you're doing the right thing with putting a flush in the ear, massaging and wiping out. I don't like to see anything bigger than your elbow go down in your dog's ear. So cotton balls, Kleenex, and so on. No Q-tips. If you use Q-tips, only where you in the nooks and crannies right up top where you can see. You don't want to be shoving anything else down in the ear. And basing on what your dog's problem is, the frequency of cleaning, you may be careful that you're not overdoing it. That can happen as well.
And thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And thanks to Deb. It's Mardi Gras. You know, here we got Fat Tuesday, and she just adopted a beautiful dog, and she's got him all decked out in beads.
A beautiful Dalmatian. And, you know, Dalmatians were one of those breeds that when the Disney movie came out, Dalmatian Association was very proactive with, you know, addressing the fact that these dogs take a lot of work. So, yeah.
So, great picture. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk with us until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network. If animals are an important part of your family, I bet you want to keep them healthy and happy. And a lot of new information coming out all the time about how to do that. A lot of different opinions. It's hard to know what to do as a responsible pet owner. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Glad to have Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine with us for the next half hour to share new information and timely advice. And, you know, whether you're a lifelong dog owner or you can't imagine life without a cat or two, you've come to the right place. She's ready to answer your questions when you call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a photo or question, a comment. There are a lot of great photos there right now. That's at The Larry Mueller Show. Click like while you're there. We'll send you regular updates on upcoming show topics. Back after the news. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here, talking your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Great to have you listening in and great to have her with us today. And I'm telling you, if you got a question, this is a great time to call. If you had a question about your pet, it's 1-800-642-1234. Or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a photo or a question or comment right there. That's at The Larry Mueller Show. Dr. Sandy, nice to have you.
Nice to be here.
And you had a question last time you were on.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't have the answer then, but you followed up on it.
Right. And, you know, anytime you have a pet with a chronic disease that needs, you know, lifetime management, it's always helpful to have support groups and know as much about it as you can. And we had a caller last time asking about diabetes in dogs and a good website to go to. And I didn't really know one off the top of my head, but I did do a little work and I found that there's one that's just very simple. CanineDiabetes.org, and it is amazing. I mean, you're going to get stuff on the different types of insulin and how to do home blood glucose monitoring and what to look for
wonderful.
When there's problems. And I mean, your vet is always your best bet, but sometimes having that information on hand, you know, really helps you out, and you kind of know what to be watching for.
And Judith will have that up on her Facebook page for sure, and we will have, so it's just a click away. You know, and Kat sent us a photo of her Java finches.
Yep.
She's wondering if they need sandpaper perches or should they have their nails trimmed instead?
Well, I'm looking at the one that's in the back, and it looks like he does have pretty long nails. And so trimming nails is the best way to do that. And I have to do it with my birds. They don't particularly like it. I have a Band-Aid on my finger because of having a little conflict with one of them this morning. But the sandpaper perches can be really irritating to the bottom of their feet. And sometimes they'll chew and eat the glue and so on that's holding that sandpaper in place. So I would avoid using that. Although they sell it at pet stores, it's not something that's recommended.
Very good. And Judith already has the diabetes site up. It's in the comment to the status for today's show. So there you go to find that. Judy in Green Bay waiting a long time. Judy, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Thank you for taking my call. I have a beautiful long-haired cat that has enough hair for two cats at least.
Oh.
The under hair gets so terribly matted. And we've tried absolutely everything to get these mats out, much to her distress. Nothing seems to work. I'm wondering if there is a product that we could use on her coat that would help keep her hair perhaps more lubricated so we could comb through it easier, something that wouldn't hurt her as she licked it off.
Nope. Easy answer. No, I mean, cats, that because her underside is matting, I assume she lets you brush her top, but the underside, because it's coming in contact with things, is going to end up getting more tangled. It's kind of like us waking up and having bedhead in the morning where our head's been in contact with the pillow. You'll have, you know, some hair matting and so on because of that. If it is matted, it can be painful, and that is a tender area for the cat. And one of the things that I'll go through with owners is if they came in with a kitten that is a long-haired kitten, I teach them kind of relaxation skills where they learn to lay on their back and enjoy having everything touched and using food rewards, maybe a little late now. But talking to a professional pet groomer regarding having your cat taken care of, you may find that your cat's going to be much more comfortable with having all that hair shaved off her ventral abdomen so that the mats are gone. And then you can start working on, while it's not painful, you know, getting her used to being touched and handled in that area. And
well,
you know, bringing,
let me explain. This is not on her underside. This is on her back.
She's her back.
Shelter save, who has had some broken ribs and can't groom totally.
So it is on her back. Yeah. Well,
it is on her back.
Yeah, and that's an area where if you've got a cat that's elderly, that is overweight, and they can't get that dead hair out, it's going to start to felt together and make those mats. And
or broken ribs, this one has.
Like this one, yeah, where they just physically can't get back there. It's up to us to take care of it. One of my favorite grooming tools when you end up with, you know, just maybe a very tiny mat so you don't cut the skin is using something called a seam ripper. You can buy them at any Notions place where you find sewing equipment, and it's just a little protected blade that you can slide and just kind of cut the hairs, you know, just a few at a time so that you're not risking cutting the skin. Cats have very elastic skin, and I never recommend scissors being used on hair mats unless they're far away from the skin. Clippers are going to be your best bet. She's going to look funny for a bit, but getting
we did the lioness cut last summer, and during the summer it's fine, but at this time of the year I hate to do it. And the house is pretty dry, and I thought perhaps that might be creating part of the problem.
No, probably not. Most of the time when you see, like, flaky skin that on the cat's back, it's because they can't reach back there to groom, and so they're getting more buildup and so on. But, you're just going to have to take care of that. Once it's matted, there's no way of releasing those mats without getting them cut out.
And then what is it again, a seam?
Seam ripper, okay?
Seam ripper,
yeah,
okay.
And it's you know, they cost a buck or two, and you can get them at any of the, you know, places that sell sewing notions.
Yeah. Well, good luck, Judy. Thank you for calling. And Gail in Fish Creek, thank you for calling. Hi.
Well, hi. Thank you for taking my call. Hi, Doctor.
Hello.
I have a question for you from a friend of mine that I had been talking to. They had a coyote that was on their property, and they managed to, I guess you can get them. The coyote had mange. They could tell it was. And so now their dog goes out and runs and is in the, you know, they've got a lot of wooded area and stuff. Is there anything that people should be watching for with a coyote's having mange in their getting mange? Because I had heard somebody's dog had gotten mange, and they wondered if it was from the coyote. I thought, I'm going to call because I think everybody...
Yeah.
Yeah. Need to know something like
that. Most of the mites that dogs get don't survive very long off of the body. There are some, like ear mites, can survive for a couple of days off the dog's body, but most of them are going to dry up, and it's just the nature of the bug. They need that to be protected and be in the skin or under the skin layers and so on to be able to survive. So unless the dog and the coyote are, you know, having very close relationships where they're touching each other, or they're sharing a resting area where the coyote may have just got up and the dog went and sat in the same area, it's unlikely that you're going to see transmission that way. But, you know, if the dog is having contact with other dogs at, like, doggy daycare or, you know, other playmates or whatever, that could potentially be the source of it. I doubt that the coyote is, but it's not impossible. It just would be, you know, the logistics of having that survive long enough and having them be in the same area.
All right. There we go. Thanks a lot, Gail, for calling. Appreciate it. And I'm just, we have more pictures on our Facebook page. Here's a great one. Donald sent one of Elvira, his witch cat.
A solid black cat. Isn't that beautiful?
Solid black cat. And then we've got, I'm not even sure.
It's two setters playing out in the snow, and it looks like they're digging for something or burying. I've got a very short video of my dog when we had that deep snow. His favorite thing to do is just bury his head and walk. And he's like bumping into bushes and into the gazebo because he has no idea where he's going. Lifts his head up, looks around, starts off again.
And here is a great shot. Stupid cat Cal.
Yeah.
This is Kimchi, a rescued cat. She dribbles from the nose a little bit when she gets to purring and making biscuits.
Is that normal? Yeah. I mean, that is a normal response. When cats are doing that, we call it the milk tread response, or as this listener said, making biscuits, where they make their front feet kind of go back and forth and stretching their toes out. That's the response that kittens have when they're nursing off of their mother. And so what this cat is doing when it starts doing that milk tread response is it's kind of reverting back to kittenhood, and it's that Pavlov's, you know, cat response where, you know, when I do this, food is coming, so I'm going to start making saliva. And sometimes you'll get even a little discharge coming from the nose as well.
Well, that is a very cute picture next to
the lucky cat. Yes, yeah.
That's very cute. Email from Kim. My lucky Belgian Malinois, Rocket, has several jobs on the farm, home of the green goats target grazing. He herds, pulls stuff around on his sled, makes friends with baby goats. Being a farm dog, he also eats a lot of things not found in commercial dog food.
Ooh, okay.
Placentas, livestock manure. He seems healthy. Can this be a problem?
Yes, definitely. We get worried about dogs that eat things that they shouldn't. Probably the biggest thing is parasite problems. The fact that, you know, I don't know how long those placentas have been laying around. They can get pretty ripe fast and can upset tummies. But having your dog on a regular deworming schedule, and it is recommended that dogs be on a monthly heartworm preventative that also controls intestinal parasites every single month, even through the winter. Probably one of our biggest problems that we have in farm dogs, though, is if they come in contact with raccoon droppings, because there is a parasite that raccoons carry that can be quite a problem for human beings. And so you've now got a dog that may be tracking this into the house or passing them in their stool. And then we just think, oh, it's just dog poop. I don't have to worry about it. And then we get exposed to it. So it's almost impossible to stop a dog from getting into things like this. But I think if you do practice good parasite control, your dog will probably do just fine.
And on Facebook, Lenora wondered, is it okay for cats to eat dog food and for dogs to eat cat food?
Yes and no. Okay, cats have a very high need for an amino acid called taurine, which dogs are able to make on their own. Cats have to have it given to them in a preformed way. And so if a cat were to eat dog food exclusively, within a few months, they would probably be in heart failure as well as blind, because the heart and the retina are two organs that require high levels of taurine. A dog eating cat food, it's an expensive taste, because because cat food tends to be pound per pound more expensive because it's higher in protein than dog food is. And so if anything, the dog may put on a little extra weight. It's not balanced for a dog, but the dog would probably be able to survive on it if that's all they were offered.
Deb in Hortonville, thanks for calling. Hi, it's your turn.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. We were a three-dog, two-cat family, and we lost three of them in 13 months.
Oh, boy.
And I have a 10-and-a-half-year-old golden, and it was just in January that the 16-and-a-half-year-old pug had to be put down.
Mm-hmm.
And she is, the golden is really moping. I thought she was, you know, in mourning.
Mm-hmm.
She snapped back for a week or two, and now she's really down again, and I'm wondering what I can do for her grieving process, or is she just paranoid because she watched three animals go out the door and not come back?
Yeah, I mean, it's first of all, the fact that she's a senior citizen golden as well, I would get her in, and I just hope, I'm keeping my fingers crossed for you, that there's nothing physically wrong with her. But she's at that age where, you know, she may be mopey for medical reasons rather than behavioral or emotional reasons. So get that taken care of first. And while you're there, you may want to talk to your veterinarian, you know, if she is being more anxious, you know, should she be on an anti-anxiety drug? Sometimes dogs just don't know how to adjust to life without having the leader of the pack there. It's hard to believe that a 16-year-old pug would able to be fulfill that leader role, but yeah. Yeah.
In the golden's face.
Okay. All right. So, you know, that may be part of it, that sometimes dogs just get so used to, okay, this dog's barking, then I need to go to the door too. This dog's going out, I need to go out too. And they just don't know how to cope. Being careful that in your grief, you're still trying to maintain your same schedule and keeping, you know, everything kind of on the same schedule if you can, feeding times, walk times, that may help as well. And this may pass. It may just be, you know, a brief passing. One thing that you could consider trying is there's a pheromone collar on the market called the DAP collar, and I think it's changed its name to Adaptil now. It's kind of made it a little bit fancier, but that has kind of a natural calming effect for dogs as well. And it, you know, if your dog is still eating and going outside and not having accidents in the house and you're not having any other problems, that would be a simple thing to consider trying to just see if this will help your dog bounce back.
Mm-hmm. Maybe the plug-in pheromones?
Could be, or the collar form. Yep, either one.
There you go. You know what? It sometimes works the other way. I remember Dr. Patricia McConnell telling me about when one of her dogs died, another of the dogs that she had, and they'd been together for quite a while, actually seemed to be happy.
Oh, yeah. Happier because, you know, if the other dog was controlling things, like not letting them get to the food bowl or just, you know, being a little pushy, maybe not, you know, right out there where the owner can see it. We can see a lot of passive aggressiveness in pets, too. You know, suddenly they're gone. It's like, wow, I have my life back. So the other way can happen.
Yeah. that can happen. Deb, thanks again. Appreciate it very much. Eric in Madison. Hi.
Hello. Morning or afternoon, doctor. Say, I've got a male lab that has some allergies. And so we took him to the vet. And I believe they gave him a steroid. We never had any ointment or anything like that. And it cleared up, and then about a month and a half or 2 months later, he starts licking his foot again and licking it. I remember the vet saying that it's a contagious, some sort of fungi. And I was wondering if, you know, like athlete's foot spray that you buy on the counter for humans would be affected with that.
I'd be really careful with using products that your dog could lick off because you can't control dosages. If you've got a dog that's licking a certain spot, just like a dog that's got itchy ears, doing cytology, actually taking some of the material, I joke and say, we've got to get some of the toe jam out and put it on a slide, have a look and see, because many of these dogs that are licking their feet, it increases the moisture between their toes, and then you can start getting yeast infections. And I'm wondering if that's what your veterinarian was identifying, is that your dog has a yeast infection.
if your dog has a yeast infection, the typical ways that we go ahead and treat it are usually with systemic, meaning an oral antifungal drug that will kill the yeast. We're typically a month or so of using one of these drugs. We may, if the feet are really inflamed, just like with an ear, we may put some steroid drops in the ear. We may use a spray steroid that you can start using daily and then maybe get down to every other day to help keep the inflammation under control. So rule out secondary infections. You know, get the itching under control with appropriate medication, not just a single shot of a steroid, but something that you can maybe apply topically. And sometimes we even have to get to the point where we put one of those nasty e-collars on a dog, the big lampshades, to keep them from working on their foot so that it has a chance to heal.
Yeah, good luck. Thanks for calling, Eric. Jamie and Kakana, hello.
Excuse me. Hello. I have a cat that I have a problem with that I had called. She has her shots and she has everything, but her owner just died. And I'm trying to, the cat just started losing her hair. And I called her vet, and the vet told me to give her Benadryl.
I've
given the cat Benadryl. She just seems to be losing so much fur.
Yeah,
and I'm not sure whether this is just kind of a stress-related shedding response, which can happen, or, you know, whether the previous owner did more grooming and you're just seeing the kind of her normal level of shedding. But if she's getting areas that are actually hairless, bald, this should be looked at by a veterinarian to make sure that there isn't something else going on there, bacterial infection or, you know, a ringworm or something else that could be causing some trouble. Most cats, I mean, if you are going to use an antihistamine, I typically use the non-sedating antihistamines. Benadryl can make them a little wiggy. They don't like it because it makes them groggy. That's just like it does for us. And so that may just be adding to, you know, whatever's going on with her. So rather than just trying to use something over the counter, why don't you get her in and have her looked at? And hopefully it's just that she's just going through a major shed and is, you know, going to bounce back and be totally normal.
Good luck again, Jamie. Thanks. Mary in Madison, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Yes, my neighbor took in a stray in the evening, and she didn't want to keep it in her apartment, but she gave me some cat food, and another neighbor gave me a box for the litter. The cat was thin, and there was a collar around her, and it was about, like, hanging about an inch.
Mm-hmm.
And she was very thin, and she was meowing quite a bit. And how much, I gave her some cat food. I tried to resist her, alarms.
Yeah.
And
oh, poor cat.
And,
yeah.
I was wondering, I gave her some milk, and I was wondering, what should you do? How much cat food should you give, and is milk all right?
Well, I think before we start worrying about feeding this cat, the fact that she had a collar on tells me that she probably is owned by somebody. And how good of you to bring her in and provide her with a meal. But I think what you need to be doing is contacting your local animal control officer to have her checked. Someone's probably missing her. And if she's got a microchip, they may be able to be relocated very quickly. But in the meantime, you know, if I would, you know, just say, if you don't have any other cats at home, you know, just let her be in your apartment, providing her with unlimited amount of food that she wants at this point. But, you know, once she's back in her old home again, then that's the time we start worrying about, you know, controlling volume. It sounds like she's been on the street for a while if she's pretty thin, and I hope we can find her owners.
Yeah, so get her to the animal control, and Humane Society.
Right, and this goes to show that just having a collar on your cat is not the only way that needs to be identified. I recommend, having microchip and a collar put on so that we have a greater chance of getting them put back with their right owner.
And to Carol with the Cocker Spaniel, with burst of viciousness, I think you really, Because we only have 15 seconds,
anytime you're dealing with aggression, this is something that needs to be worked with an applied animal behaviorist. It is not something you want to address on your own, nor is it something that I can answer with just a simple 15-second answer. So,
thank you, Dr. Sandy.
You are welcome.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk will be back. Our next appearance, March 12th. So always great to have her along, and always great to have you listening. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network.